escalated tensions in the West Asia region. In Hania's funeral, people said the path of resistance will be followed stronger than ever, and that they continue to uphold the principles that the Hamas leader championed.
Today we say goodbye to our leader Ismail Haniyeh, the one whom the Zionist regime thought that by assassinating him it could divert our path, or weaken our will, or reduce our efforts. By committing this new crime, the Zionist regime has shown the whole world that it is the manifestation of evil in the region. The whole world now should work together to eradicate this cancer.
Iranians from across the country converge in the capital to take part in Ismail Haniyeh's funeral and a display of unity with the people in Gaza, an untrammeled support for the Palestinian cause.
We came today to support the people of Gaza and say that we are with you until the end. With the martyrdom of Ismail Haniyeh, the resistance will only become stronger. Hopefully, this genocide in Gaza will end soon.
I have come to show solidarity with the people of Gaza. God willing, they will be the victors. God willing, with resistance and patience, Israel will soon be destroyed.
The Iranian capital witnessed large crowds of mourners who came together to pay their support and bid farewell to martyr Ismail Haniyeh and pledge their support for the Palestinian cause. Reza Hashemi, Tehran.
White House National Security Advisor John Kirby says the recent warning by Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei regarding the revenge for the assassination of Hamas Political Bureau Chief Ismail Haniyeh must be taken seriously. In a televised interview, Kirby said Tehran has already proven that it is able and willing to carry out major attacks against Israel. He also noted that the U.S. will implement all necessary precautions to ensure the defense of itself and its allies in the region. On Wednesday, Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei issued a stern warning to Israel, promising a harsh response for Haniyeh's assassination. He emphasized that Iran considers it a duty to avenge the blood of the Hamas leader who was martyred on the Iranian territory. People in the Lebanese capital have bid their somber farewell to Hezbollah military commander Fuad Shukr, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike on Tuesday. During the funeral ceremony of Shukr, Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah vowed that the Lebanese resistance movement will avenge Israel's killing of his commander. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, has this report.
Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has described as inevitable the retaliation for Israel's killing of the Lebanese movement's top commander, Fuad Shukr.
The enemy and those who are behind it must await our inevitable response. There is no doubt in this regard. The upcoming days and nights, as well as the battlefield, will prove we are working on a real and very calculated response.
During the funeral ceremony of Hezbollah commander Fuad Shukr, who was killed in an Israeli strike on a residential building in a Beirut suburb, Nasrallah underlined that Israel has seriously crossed the red lines. The Hezbollah chief added that the region has entered a new era following the assassination of both Fuad Shukr and head of Hamas political bureau Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran. Nasrallah's words resonated strongly among the supporters of the resistance in Lebanon.
We are with the resistance and stand by the resistance. We are the people of the resistance, and this Israeli aggression is not new for us. We're all ready to be martyred.
They are foolish if they think they can weaken our resistance by assassinating our leaders. These assassinations make us stronger. Even if they kill us all, we will not forsake Gaza and the Palestinian cause.
God willing, the oppressors will be punished, and we have full trust in the leadership of the resistance.
We give this gift to the martyrs in Palestine and the children of Palestine and the women of Palestine. Our cause is one. It is the cause of every human being for the sake of humanity and against the enemies of humanity.
Despite the martyrdom of our men from the early years of resistance until now, this movement has become stronger. We will defeat the enemies, Israel and the U.S., thanks to the blood of our martyrs.
The assassination of Hezbollah's commander is expected to set off a new phase of resistance operations, which would show the capabilities of the Lebanese resistance group in the face of Israel's intensified aggression.
The leader of the Lebanese resistance has vowed retaliation for the assassination of top military commander Fuad Shammas. Previous assassinations of Hezbollah commanders has not hindered the movement's determination. So this incident could perhaps make it even more steadfast and powerful. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Yemeni leaders and citizens have attended the gathering to offer the condolences of the martyrdom of Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh. They have pledged to continue their unwavering support for the Palestinian resistance. Abdul Latif Awashali reports from Sana'a.
In Yemen's capital, Sana'a, the office of the Islamic resistance movement Hamas has become a place of mourning. Leaders and citizens alike are gathering to offer their condolences following the martyrdom of Ismail Haniyeh, head of Hamas political bureau.
Today, all the people of Palestine see Yemen's positions and feel proud and honored and feel that they have support and backing from Yemenis after many leaders and presidents abandoned the Palestinian people and their resistance in this ordeal. Yemen's standing with Palestine raises the morale of the people of Palestine, and they realize that they are not alone, but alongside them are the people of the Yemeni nation, and this motivates the Palestinian people for more resistance and patience amid challenges.
The attendees expressed deep sadness over the loss of what they described as an influential figure in the Palestinian resistance movement. Among them were key Yemeni figures who assured Hamas delegates that Yemen's support for the Palestinian cause remains unwavering. They emphasized that Yemen will continue its backing for the Palestinian resistance until victory is achieved.
The martyrdom of the Arab and Islamic leader Ismail Haniyeh was a great shock to the Palestinian people and the Arab people as a whole. There is a great pain, especially since this man was the most prominent unifying figure within the movement, as he was very cooperative with other Palestinian factions. Haniyeh's martyrdom will unite the Palestinian resistance more and will push for greater steadfastness.
Abdul Malik al-Houthi, leader of the Ansarullah movement, vowed to avenge Haniyeh's martyrdom. Al-Houthi pledged full cooperation with resistance forces across the region, declaring that no effort will be spared in seeking retribution for Haniyeh and other martyrs. He warned that the targeting of resistance leaders has escalated the conflict and that such actions will have severe repercussions for the Israeli regime and its allies.
Observers say the solidarity shown in Yemen reflects broader regional support for the Palestinian resistance and underscores the ramifications of Haniyeh's martyrdom on the region, signaling potential escalations in already tense and turbulent West Asia. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
We earlier talked to former CIA analyst Larry Johnson about Iran's possible retaliatory operations against the Israeli regime after the assassination of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh. Here's what he had to say.
I think what we've seen out of the Houthis in Yemen is one way where they're not killing people, but boy, they're certainly putting an economic hurt on Israel and demonstrating that the West is really powerless to stop them. You know, who would have imagined that a small country like Yemen and an even smaller group like the Houthis could withstand the full might of the U.S. Navy and supported by European allies? You know, they've been doing it now for 9 months, 8 months. It's remarkable. So I think the Houthis have shown that there's perhaps another approach. And I think that, Turkey is a key player in this, that if Turkey would simply cut off the oil, or if Turkey doesn't have the will to cut off the oil, then, groups that are aligned with Hamas and Hezbollah should undertake efforts to destroy those pipelines. Because once that oil stops flowing to Israel, Israel's ability to continue killing Palestinian women and children would end. And I think that this glorification of violence for violence sake has it's hurt Israel, hurt the Zionists.
It's nearly 10 months into the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The regime continues to pound the Palestinian territory with more airstrikes and artillery fire. In one of the latest attacks, at least 3 people were killed in Israeli bombing of a residential building in central Gaza City. Several people were also injured. Elsewhere in central Gaza, regime warplanes struck the Deir al-Balah area, killing a number of Palestinians. 8 civilians were also killed after Israeli jets targeted a civilian vehicle near the al-Maghazi refugee camp. In Khan Yunis, southern Gaza, a Palestinian woman was killed in an airstrike on a home. The regime's artillery fire also targeted several areas across Gaza, leaving an unknown number of Palestinians dead or injured. A total of nearly 39,500 Palestinians have been killed and over 91,000 injured since the regime's genocide started last October. A group of Palestinian prisoners recently released from Israeli prisons say they were subjected to the most severe torture and physical abuse during their imprisonment.
They forced us to sit down on our feet. We weren't allowed to move. We were blindfolded. We weren't allowed to move or talk. If you spoke to the person next to you, they would bring out the army squad, which included dogs and electrocution, and they would start beating you.
Those released had been in Israeli prisons since the regime started its onslaught on Gaza last October. Several of the released detainees said prisoners suffered extreme torture, both physical and mental. They also revealed that Israeli prisons deliberately used starvation as a means of punishment. Earlier, the UN Human Rights Office had reported that thousands of Palestinians, including medics and patients, have been taken from Gaza to Israel while shackled and blindfolded. They were given no reason for their detention and had no access to a lawyer or effective judicial review. The UN office estimated that at least 53 detainees from Gaza and the occupied West Bank have died in Israeli detention in the past 10 months. Another Palestinian detainee has died in Israeli prisons as a result of mistreatment against them. According to Palestine Prisoner Society, 42-year-old Islam al-Sirsawi succumbed to wounds suffered from torture in the notorious Deit Haman detention center. He was abducted during a recent Israeli raid on the Al-Shifa hospital amid the ongoing Gaza genocide. This brings the total number of Gaza prisoners who have died in Israeli jails since October the 7th to 20th to 20, with many more still unaccounted for. Nearly 10,000 prisoners from Gaza are currently held in Israeli jails, including 4,000 abducted since last October. Abductees are usually subjected to all sorts of physical and mental torture, including sexual abuse and starvation. Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan has called for the establishment of a security pact in West Asia region. He made the remarks following the assassination of Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran. Rashan Saglam reports.
Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan suggested in an interview with Turkish broadcaster Channel 7 that forming a regional security alliance in West Asia could help stabilize the area. The top diplomat said the security pact will forge a trust among regional countries and prevent unnecessary interventions from outside.
We do not want to remain a country that only sees and describes the problem in the region. We also care about bringing real, applicable solutions to them. This is not the first war, nor the last. But one thing is important. We must develop a capability and capacity to be ready for any kind of struggle.
Hakan did not specify which countries would be involved in the pact, but analysts say the potential alliance will include as many West Asian countries as possible.
I believe that forming a security alliance in the region will enhance political and military coordination among the countries of the region, which they currently lack. This is not a new idea, as we have previously heard about plans to establish an Arab or regional alliance like NATO to serve the interests of the West Asia. As for the countries involved, the minister did not mention any specific names, but I believe the alliance will aim to include as many West Asian countries as possible, especially those surrounding Palestine.
Turkey is already part of a security alliance, which is US-led NATO. However, it seems that there are conflicting interests among the bloc's member states in various issues. Therefore, Ankara seems to be trying to initiate new alliances.
I don't think the regional security alliance would affect NATO, as each alliance has its own geographic scope and specific objectives.
Turkey has been recently making concerted effort to strengthen ties with regional countries. This was evident from Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's latest meetings with high-ranking regional officials, including from Iran and Egypt. He also called for a meeting with his Syrian counterpart after years of severed ties. Last week, Turkish Foreign Minister said Ankara is seeking stronger ties with Arab countries, including Syria and Egypt. It appears that Turkey is now focusing on strengthening ties with regional countries instead of seeking Western acceptance of its role as a regional power. Rakhshan Saglam, Istanbul.
With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The charitable organization Oxfam has urged wealthy nations to boost spending on ending hunger ahead of a Group of Seven annual summit in Italy, saying that just 3% of the G7 military spending could help solve the global food and debt crisis. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Common Dreams website has covered this story and tells us more. A recent analysis shows that if the group of seven countries allocated just 2.9% of their annual military spending, they could effectively resolve the world's food and debt crisis. The revelation by Oxfam comes ahead of the G7 summit in Borgo Egnazia, Italy, which estimates that the G7's fair share of debt relief efforts for the world's poorest countries is equivalent to $4 billion, for a total of $35.7 billion. Oxfam International's head of inequality policy, Max Lawson, said, "Governments are finding their pockets run deep to fund war today, but when it comes to stopping starvation, they're suddenly broke." Max Lawson added, "We're talking about a small commitment with a potential for huge impact. Imagine a world where no one goes to bed hungry and where countries in the global south can put money into the public schools and hospitals instead of paying debt interests. The G7 nations not only have the means, but the moral and strategic imperative to make this happen." According to a United Nations report, more than 281 million people worldwide are currently experiencing the devastating effect of extreme hunger and malnutrition. The Gaza Strip is confronted with a dire hunger crisis, which ranks among the most severe worldwide, primarily attributed to Israel's brutal military assault on the territory. Oxfam also urged the G7 nations to reaffirm their call on Israel to comply with the recent decision of the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, by ceasing aggression in Rafah and allowing entry of humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip. Nations have a legal obligation under the Genocide Convention and international humanitarian law to utilize all available political, economic, and military means to prevent genocide. This encompasses the immediate cessation of arms and munitions exports that are being used in war crimes or aid in the occurrence of genocide. The responsibility to prevent genocide extends beyond mere complicity, as states are required to take action. Max Lawson said, "The G7's collective failure has basically given the Israeli military a free pass to commit terrible atrocities against Palestinians in Gaza. G7 leaders must do everything in their power to make sure there is an immediate and permanent ceasefire to stop the death and destruction in Gaza. They also need to ensure full and permanent access of humanitarian aid through all ground crossings and the release of all captives and unlawfully detained Palestinian civilians." Max Lawson added, "The G7 must also deploy all diplomatic efforts to stop further escalation in Lebanon and Yemen should regional instability escalate into an all-out war. The devastation will spare no one." Oxfam's research has revealed that G7 nations have a debt of $15 trillion to low- and middle-income countries for aid and climate funding, yet they are pressuring developing countries to pay $291 million daily in debt repayments and interests. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Charity Oxfam urged wealthy nations to boost spending on ending hunger ahead of a Group of Seven annual summit in Italy, saying that just 3% of the G7's military spending could help solve the global food and debt crisis. The Group of Seven industrialized nations, known as G7, made up of United States, Japan, Canada, Germany, France, Italy and Britain, met in Italy on Thursday, 13th of June, where leaders discussed issues such as climate change, migration and heavy debt load in developing countries, calculating that eradicating global hunger would require $31.7 billion annually and that the G7's share of debt relief for the poorest countries would land at a further $4 billion. Oxfam said these together accounted for just 2.9% of the $1.2 trillion estimated spent by the G7 on the military last year. Oxfam International's inequality policy chief Max Lawson said in a statement, "Governments are finding their pockets run deep to fund war today, but when it comes to stopping starvation, they are suddenly broke." Some 167 million people worldwide are suffering crisis-level hunger or worse, according to the IPC, a worldwide benchmark for world hunger, which has warned that lack of funds is preventing it from meeting growing demands and will force it to reduce the scope of its work. Oxfam called on the G7 nations to halt arms exports that may be used in war crimes, boost taxes for billionaires, provide tax relief to poor countries to free up budgets for development and fulfill outstanding aid and climate pledges. It calculated that seven countries owed some $15 trillion to states in the so-called Global South in outstanding aid commitments and unfulfilled pledges for climate financing, including the Loss and Damage Fund. Max Lawson added, "Families are struggling to get food on the table, our tax systems are making the rich richer, and the solution is glaringly obvious. We're talking about a small commitment with a potential for a huge impact." Common Dreams website has also covered the same story. An analysis published on Friday, 14th of June, revealed despite historic levels of forced displacement due to armed conflict, the group of seven industrialized nations have increased their military expenditure to record highs, while they slashed spending on humanitarian aid for people affected by wars that these powerful nations often started or stoked. According to Islamic Relief Worldwide, an organization based in Birmingham, England, military spending by G7 industrialized countries, including Canada, France, Italy, Germany, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States, which wrapped up their meeting on Friday in Puglia, Italy, rose to $1.2 trillion last year, the overwhelming bulk of that amount attributable to the U.S. at $886.3 billion, Pentagon budget. It said too many governments are putting far more resources towards acquiring weapons of war than helping those suffering the deadly impacts of conflict. That's a 7.3% increase over 2022 levels, and 62 times what those countries spent on all humanitarian aid in response to wars and disasters. Islamic Relief Worldwide head of global advocacy Shahin Ashraf said in a statement, "From Gaza to Sudan, from Ukraine to Myanmar, we see millions of lives destroyed by war. The humanitarian needs today are greater than ever before, so it's scandalous that many wealthy G7 nations are cutting aid while spending more than ever before on weaponry." It's not just the G7 industrialized nations. According to this year's Stockholm International Peace Research Institute's annual analysis, global military spending increased 6.8% to a record $2.4 trillion in 2023. Shahin Ashraf said, "Too many governments are putting far more resources towards acquiring weaponry of war than helping those suffering the deadly impacts of conflict. More must be invested in eradicating poverty and fostering peace and development, not fueling war and destruction."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special.
There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Muslim Lady. Well, this is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be your host, and here with me, I have Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. Well, it's always a pleasure to be here with you and have to talk about a lot of interesting things. As the ritual of this program goes, we always ask you to introduce yourself, just as a reminder for all of those people who do not know you, your background.
Well, I am Zainab Askari, and I come from Indian administrated Kashmir, from where I did my master's in linguistics. And then it's been some 10 years I have been studying Hausa here in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And in the past 2 years, I was like researching on the women's specific topics, mm-hmm. and have been working on that and also writing on that.
Yeah, that's so great. Wish you luck. How much do you complain in your life, sister? That's a personal question. I have this critical thinking and perspective toward everything. So sometimes I might think that I'm a nagging person. How much real it is. But then I sometimes think that maybe I'm prone to be called as a nagging person.
Well, that was a very serious question, I would say. And it's really difficult to answer this. Well, I had been asking my husband what I was researching on this topic, like, why do people complain? I asked him, what do you think why women complain? And maybe you will laugh on this. He said that, had I known why you complained, I would have actually cured that. So, because I don't know why you complain. So, yes, I got to know I'm also a complaining person. Nowadays, actually, if you were to meet anyone and ask them how they were doing, they seem to have been anxiously waiting for this particular question. And their response is a list of complaints. You know, a husband complains about his wife, and the wife complains about the husband and the kids. Kids complain about their parents and not understanding them and not spending time with them. While parents complain about the kids, they do not do their homework or do not respect their parents. An employer complains about the employees, while the employees complain about the employer. So everybody is complaining about the other person, no? Mm-hmm. So why are actually there so many people constantly complaining? Constant need to complain has a simple and fundamental reason, and that is a lack of sense of contentment.
Again, the lost key in human beings' lives.
Yes. So in other words, dissatisfaction has taken the place of contentment in their hearts, and as a result is reflected in all the words they utter, in all their behavior, in all the way they say about their lives. So complaining is actually a way to communicate dissatisfaction.
Yeah, but unfortunately, unfairly, some people try to attribute that to women. Like they call that as it's only women who are the complaining and the nagging creatures. Like they all the time come. Of course, we do not accept that. But I would say that since women are mother, and since women are those who care much for detail, they are much prone into seeing more of this life.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So before we go for a break, we were just talking about, we're actually starting to get into the very heart of complaining. Why and what? So the first thing is that, what are the things that we mostly complain about? And then we're going to come to the point of why.
Yeah, so I'll give you some of the complaints of the wives or the female partners that are actually He's disconnected. He's not supportive. He's not appreciative. And he does not seem to care. And he has a better relationship with others, like maybe his family, maybe his mother, sister, and all. He either can't or won't talk about feelings or emotions, and except for anger. You know, whenever he's angry, he's expressive. And other than that, he's not. He's so much on mobile phone. He has lost interest in me. He's passive, and he avoids responsibilities. You know, there are so many complaints that are very, very common. And the important thing is that we said that it's no surprise that complaints tend to be counterproductive, because the more she complains, the more he feels unappreciated. You know, it's not like if you are complaining about things and now it's the solution. No, it's not. The worse he feels, the more passive-aggressive he becomes. Remember that. And now she has even more to complain about. A negative cycle develops and keeps repeating itself. The antidote is quite simple, but a full intention. With effort and commitment is necessary. Like, so it's not to say that you cannot complain at all, but try to direct your complaint to the person it concerns. Like, do not just complain for the sake of complaining, and do not make a complaint an icebreaker or a topic of discussion.
But is there anyone who would complain for the sake of complaining? Of course not. I mean, look, it's something natural. Like, as a human being, I sometimes get into a situation in which I see more than other people. What happens is that they do not have an understanding of what I understand. I have to justify them. I have to clarify the situation for them. What I do is that I would try to speak about what I see. It turns out to look like a complaint, but I did not deliberately mean to complain. You know what I mean? I mean, most of the time, what we as ladies do is that we try to talk about our own perspective, and what other people see is complain. But we're not complaining. We're just adding to your knowledge.
See, first of all, our list of complaints should be there in front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, not the common people. Because when someone is viewed as a chronic complainer, other people may not engage. You know, not everyone is going to listen to you, because no one really wants to be around someone who complains constantly. Generally, people want to be around balanced and moderate people. Mm-hmm. So if someone is too bitter, or for that matter, too happy, others tend to avoid them or perhaps complain about them. So even if you have a list of complaints, either talk to the person who is concerned, or just talk to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, let's get back to why women complain. Our focus was women, because women see insecurity. You know, a woman's complaint often stems from a sense of insecurity, especially in a marriage. She feels neglected, even in the family. Like, even if a woman is single, if she feels neglected by her parents, brother, sister, and if she doubts their attention, like she is not now the center of attraction in the family, she has this insecurity and she speaks up. And
that speak up looks like a complaint.
Yes, like she may resort to voicing her concerns repeatedly. So what should be done is actually spend quality time with each other. Spend quality time with this female who is constantly seems to be complaining, and reaffirm that our attention is there for you. Our
reaffirm
love is there
their
for
existence.
Yes,
actually,
because this will elevate these insecurities and reduce the frequency of these complaints in them.
Yeah. So what do you say if we go for a short break, and then we'll come back to follow the rest? Welcome back. This is Muslim Lady. I'm Asma. Sister Zainab is in here, and we're talking about why do women complain? Well, the very first place we have to clarify this point that women do not complain. All that they do is to shed light on things that other people can't see. So this is just for clarification. And then you were talking about the what sort of things women usually complain about. Again, they do not complain. They just speak about things that other people are unaware of. So, and you mentioned some point about their married life, like she's going to complain whenever she feels like there is a problem, like all the problems that are related to the partner, the husband. And then we came to this point that sometimes even that single girl that's living with her parent would start complaining. When the list of complaining is to grow, that's the alarming point where you, as the people who are surrounding her, have to notice. Why? Because maybe there are some insecurities. Maybe she's feeling neglected, and you have to reassure her that, well, no, your existence is very important and worthy for us. We care for you. And the same thing happens when a Muslim lady is married. When she starts to complain, as other people say it, of course, you must come and see what's happening around her. There must be an alarming point happening around her.
Yes. So sometimes it's an emotional expression. Like some women resort to complaining as a means of expressing their hurt, or they seek attention, like we said earlier as well. So rather than intending to harm their parents, they use words as a tool to convey their emotions. And what you can do is you can acknowledge their feelings and you can engage in actually open communication, the conversation you can have with them, and there would be more understanding. And also sometimes women use it as a defense mechanism. Like women may feel compelled to defend themselves in situations where they perceive threat. So this defense stance can manifest as frequent complaints as they strive to assert equality and protect their interests. Again, there are certain individuals that exhibit a propensity for dominance and control. You know, sometimes you really don't have any issues, but you want to be dominant over the other person. So that's also one of the reasons why you do that. And sometimes it's fear. Sometimes it's stress. Sometimes it's anxiety. Excessive anxiety can again exacerbate a woman's tendency to complain, particularly when faced with unexpected challenges that she was not expecting in her mm-hmm. life, and also some calamities or like uncertainties that she goes through. So also there are high expectations or unrealistic expectations that set the stage for disappointment and frustration. When the woman is not met with those expectations, she expresses the complaints. And if you're impatient,
yeah, like
we are told constantly, Quran teaches us, Inna Allaha ma'as sabirin, indeed Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is with the patient. But sometimes we are so impatient with the situations, we're so impatient with the uncertainties of life, and we resort to complaining when faced with the, for example, delays or obstacles, when we are seeking some immediate resolution to some particular problem. And there are delays, there's not immediate solution, we are not getting that. And we are very, very impatient, so we start complaining. Apart from this, there are the societal expectations regarding the gender roles and the behavior that further reinforce this pattern. So while women may indeed complain more frequently than men, understanding the underlying reasons behind this behavior is really, really crucial to, you know, to improve that particular relationship. Mm-hmm. So you have to address the insecurities, you have to have open communication with her, and you have to promote the mutual respect to navigate these conflicts.
Exactly. So in order to avoid all of these issues, just listen to her. That's all she wants. So this is all the time that we had for today's episode. I hope you just enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Despite being bombed, besieged, and imprisoned by the Zionist regime, doctors and nurses across Gaza remain devoted to their patients. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, since October 7, 2023, the Zionist regime forces have killed hundreds of Palestinian healthcare workers and imprisoned others under inhumane conditions. The ongoing attacks on physicians, nurses, paramedics, and aid providers, coupled with the destruction of Gaza's health infrastructure, are central to the ongoing genocide. Throughout this period, we have witnessed the bravery and steadfastness of medical teams in Gaza, who have shown remarkable resourcefulness in addressing the needs of their parents, even as the Zionist regime strikes have destroyed the region's hospitals. The commitment and fortitude displayed by healthcare workers have been aptly characterized as a form of resistance. Their tireless service amid severely challenging conditions, including shortages of essential food and medicine, is to be commended. Many have received distressing reports of family members killed or wounded in Israeli regime airstrikes, but this has not deterred them from fulfilling their professional and moral obligations. This perseverance has played a pivotal role in allowing certain medical facilities to continue operating amid the Zionist regime's relentless attacks. Some hospitals hit by airstrikes have resumed operations in a limited capacity despite suffering significant damage. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, several operating rooms were restored at Ashrafa Hospital in January. But just 2 months later, the Zionist regime stormed the facility again, putting it out of service forever, according to its acting chairman. During a December raid of Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, the Zionist regime army reportedly used bulldozers to dig up bodies recently buried in makeshift graveyards in the facility's courtyard and arrested the hospital's director. Despite immense hardships, it was still able to function partially until this past May, when Israel bombed and besieged the hospital again, halting its services. The Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza, which sustained severe damage and was rendered inoperative due to Israel's bombardment and siege, resumed operations amid joyous celebrations by healthcare professionals in May. Among those celebrating was Munir Albersh, the Director General of the Palestinian Health Ministry, who lost his daughter and suffered a back injury in an Israeli airstrike in Jabalia. Despite moving from one hospital to another, Bersh continued to work tirelessly to help injured Palestinians, even as these facilities were attacked and shut down one by one. Such unwavering devotion is intrinsically influenced by political factors. Gaza's healthcare providers are committed not only to upholding their professional ethics and serving their parents, but also to saving Gaza's population. As Surgeon Ghassan Abu Sette noted in an interview with Al Jazeera, those in charge of Gaza's healthcare system made a national decision not to evacuate hospitals, as this would have been tantamount to participating in the crime of ethnic cleansing. Such sentiments have been echoed by numerous healthcare professionals. Adnan Albersh, a prominent Palestinian orthopedic surgeon who died in an Israeli prison in April, often delivered emotional testimonies highlighting his colleagues' steadfastness in the face of Israeli destruction. In his last post on X, formerly Twitter, he wrote, "We die standing and we will not kneel." On October 29th, Ashrafa Hospital was being besieged and he posted this, "Steadfast, we will not leave except for heaven or to our homes in dignity." He later told Al Jazeera, "We left the hospital with a heavy heart, but thankfully, we fulfilled our mission." In February, Munir Albersh posted on X, "We will not leave the field of honor despite the famine and genocide against our steadfast people." Mohammad Abu Salmiya, the director of Ashrafa Hospital, was recently released from Israeli regime prison after 7 months in detention. The Zionist regime forces abducted him from a UN humanitarian convoy transporting wounded patients from the hospital last November after they invaded the facility. After his release, Abu Salmiya posted on social media, "We were arrested from Ashrafa Hospital and we will return to Ashrafa Hospital. We will rebuild it from the scratch, and with God's will, it will be even better in service of our people." Abu Salmiya has also spoken out about the dire situation of Palestinian prisoners and the crimes committed against them by Israeli regime authorities. Many of his colleagues are still in detention, facing harsh and inhumane conditions. Shortly after his release, Abu Salmiya returned to Nasser Hospital to alleviate suffering and support what remains of Gaza's healthcare system. His release came as a relief to many, especially after the tragic deaths of Adnan Albersh and another doctor, Iyad Al-Rantisi, in Israeli regime custody, along with multiple reports of torture and inhumane treatment in Israeli regime detention centers. Over the past 10 months, we have seen countless testimonies from healthcare workers, including hospital directors, expressing their refusal to evacuate hospitals and leave their patients. Unfortunately, their appeals to the global medical community have been to no avail. Similarly, their appeals to the Zionist regime army to avoid evacuations that would jeopardize patient safety have also been ignored. The deliberate targeting of health workers compromises the overall well-being and survival of Gaza's population. The Zionist regime's evacuation orders for hospitals in the besieged enclave were strategically designed to cultivate a pervasive sense of insecurity among the thousands seeking refuge in these medical facilities. This calculated measure, combined with the deliberate destruction of vital health infrastructure, has undermined the sanctity and security of what should be protected places under international norms.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Says the Iranian leader's statements about revenge must be taken seriously as Iran has proven it can launch a major attack on Israel. Israel's unrelenting strikes killed dozens more civilians across Gaza, with a death toll from the regime's genocidal war approaching 39,500. And Palestinian abductees released from Israeli jails provide chilling accounts of severe torture and mistreatment during their imprisonment. Thank you for joining. Iranians have gathered en masse to mourn the loss of Hamas political chief Ismail Haniyeh, who was assassinated in Tehran on Wednesday. Reza Hashemi has the details.
The funeral of Hamas political chief Ismail Haniyeh commenced with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, leading the funeral prayers. Iranian and Hamas political figures, along with mourners, come together in the Iranian capital, Tehran, to take part in the ceremony. Politicians and citizens alike called for justice, assuring that the Israeli assassination would not go unavenged.
Another mistake of the Zionist regime is that they do not pay attention to the words of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. If the enemy attacks, they shall receive counterattacks. We have shown this through time.
Hamas political chief Ismail Haniyeh was killed in a strike on his residence in Tehran on Wednesday. The Israeli